Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Mohammed El-Shenawy, senior reporter in VOA's English division. Our guest on this edition of the program is Robert Kaplan. He's a best-selling author of over a dozen books on international affairs and travel. His two most recent books are Asia's Cauldron, The South China Sea and the End of a Stable Pacific, and The Revenge of Geography, What the Map Tells Us About Coming Conflicts and the Battle Against Fate. Robert Kaplan is also foreign correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine, the chief geopolitical analyst for Stratfor, a private intelligence firm, and a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. And that's a think tank based here in Washington. In his book, The Revenge of Geography, What the Map Tells Us About Coming Conflicts and the Battle Against Fate, Robert Kaplan argues that in order to understand today's current events, religious conflict, war, political instability, one need look no further than a map. He states that when the political grounds shift rapidly under one's feet, it is the map that provides the first step towards discerning a historical logic about what might come next. To Kaplan, geography matters. Despite globalization and the social media revolution, Robert Kaplan says timeless truths and natural facts are equally, if not more, important factors in determining the course of history. Well, Robert Kaplan, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Well, Robert Kaplan, let's start with your previous book, The Revenge of Geography. In that, you say, as I said in the introduction, that in times of upheaval, maps rise in importance. Why do you say that?
Because in an age of high technology and electronic communications, this has not negated geography. It has just made it more claustrophobic and more precious. Now there is no place in the world that is not strategic. Every place can affect every other place. We used to be able to say Africa doesn't matter or South America doesn't matter. Now it does. But think of the Earth like a small wristwatch that's getting smaller. In order to understand how that wristwatch works, you have to take it apart and see all the mountains and valleys and rivers, because that's the only way to get a sense of what's going on in country A, country B, country C. The world is not a world of multinational organizations and globalization. That's only the upper layer of it. Beneath that, you still have the battle of space and power, known as geopolitics, played out in a geographical setting. And within each country, you can often tell why Tunisia is the way it is, why Egypt is the way it is. What are these disagreements in the South China Sea? What are President Putin's advantages in the Ukraine and disadvantages? You start with a map, the same way you'd start your child when he said, "Tell me about the world, mommy or daddy." You say, "Here's a map. Here's where Ukraine is. Here's where Egypt is." Think of the map as, in the 19th century term of geography, as a starting point for a discovery of trade routes, natural resources, the layout of human populations, ethnic and cultural groups, and so on.
Well, that's a very interesting analysis. And that leads me to ask you about the crisis in Ukraine. Many analysts arguing that it's the sharpest east-west conflict in Europe since the end of the Cold War, and a historic test for the United States and transatlantic leadership. Given what we're witnessing today with Russia's annexation of Crimea, how does your thesis apply or not?
It's totally geographic, because the Ukraine is the ultimate buffer border state in Central and Eastern Europe. It was easy to bring from Estonia to Bulgaria into NATO and the EU, but Ukraine is so thrust forward into Russia itself and so spatially semi-surrounded by Russia that the idea that the Ukraine could be a normal country without a very stable relationship with Moscow is geographically unacceptable. You take the city of Smolensk in Russia, which used to be in the heart of Russia. You put Ukraine in the West and suddenly Smolensk is a border city. The whole warm water Russian Navy is in Crimea. No Russian leader is going to allow that Navy to be governed by a pro-Western government in Kiev. Think of the world from Vladimir Putin's point of view. He governs half the longitudes of the Earth, but he has less people than Bangladesh. His country has been invaded not just by Hitler and Napoleon, but by Poles, Lithuanians, and Swedes as well. He needs that warm water access from the Crimea. He can't have cities like Smolensk as border cities. This is all geography. He's doing the minimum, as any Russian leader would.
I take that you're not necessarily defending his
I'm not
moves.
Defending him. I'm explaining. I'm not approving.
Indeed. One quick question before I turn to Mohammed, and that is, I take your point about geography, and certainly Russia wants to maintain influence in Crimea, the Black Sea, and so forth, but couldn't it have done that if it had decided to take a different approach, one that would lead to negotiations?
Remember, because of geography, Ukraine matters a lot more to Moscow than it matters to the West. It matters more to Russia than it matters to Germany and certainly to the United States. It's of great interest to Europe, of reasonable interest to the U.S., but it's absolutely vital for Russia because Russia grew out of Ukraine from the 9th century state of Kiev and Rus. Ukraine makes Russia a European country if Ukraine is part of Russia. Russia cannot afford to lose Ukraine. Putin thought he could control Kiev through his intelligence services, through buying off politicians, etc. The Russians are good at corruption. They organize corruption very well. But he couldn't. His intelligence services could not deliver for him. The government fell. So Putin fell back on geography, 10,000 troops in a maneuver to the east of eastern Ukraine. Eastern Ukraine is Orthodox. It's not Catholic. It's more pro-Russian than pro-Western. He's using his geopolitical advantages since his intelligence services failed him in Kiev.
Let's move to the Middle East and try your theory. The Middle East is going through what was called the Arab Spring, which so far brought a lot of turmoil. As a nearby region to Europe, which direction would geography take the region?
If you look at Tunisia and Egypt, they are age-old clusters of civilization. Tunisia is Greater Carthage. Most of the roads you would drive on in the northern third of Tunisia today were originally laid by the Romans and kept up by various conquerors through the French. It was always something. It was always a real state. Same with Egypt, Nile Valley civilization going back 4,000 years or more. So Tunisia and Egypt today have bad situations. Tunisia is a very, very weak, very, very fragile democracy. Egypt is governed by a military, but they govern. The state is not collapsed in each of these two countries because it was always a state there to begin with. But if you juxtapose Tunisia and Egypt against Libya, Syria, and Iraq, and partially Yemen, you will see places that were never states in the first place, that were not age-old clusters of civilization, that were just vague geographical expressions, so that when the dictator collapsed or was brought low in Libya, Syria, and in Iraq, for whatever reason, the whole state crumbled, essentially, unlike in the case of Tunisia and Egypt. Yemen's more of a mixed bag. Yemen is an age-old cluster of civilization, but not one civilization, half a dozen, even in antiquity, you know, the different kingdoms of the spice route, because Yemen is so infernally mountainous. So that the places that were real, naturally geographic hubs have held together, however badly or dismally. The places that were never anything geographically have just pulverized.
Would you say that Syria falls into that latter category?
Yes. Yes, it does. Syria is just a vague geographical expression from the southern foothills of the Taurus Mountains in Turkey to the Nefud Desert in Saudi Arabia. It encompasses what are the present-day countries of Syria, Israel, Lebanon, Jordan. It has Shia-trending Alawites in the northwest. It has Kurds in the northeast. It has Sunnis in the center. It has Druze in the south. Hafez al-Assad, who governed Syria for 30 years, had the opportunity to overcome geography by turning his subjects into citizens with a civil society. He didn't take advantage of that three decades of stability. I always called Hafez al-Assad the Leonid Brezhnev of the Middle East, because he had stability, but he did nothing with it. So that once things started to unravel under his son, there was nothing there. There was no loyalty to the state that superseded a loyalty to an ethnicity or a region or a sect.
Quick follow-up. There's so much controversy over should the West or the Friends of Syria have done more to help the opposition. Could any of these interventions have changed the course of events, in your view?
Of course. Look, I'm not denying human agency here. Geography sets broad parameters, very broad. And within that, individual choice, you know, determines much. We don't know what would have happened had the U.S. led an intervention in Syria in 2011.
Now, I don't know about leading an intervention, but I think that there was talk about at least helping supply weaponry, defensive weaponry, and so forth to the rebel opposition.
I think the president, President Obama, that is, was very worried about doing something that would midwife to power a Sunni jihadist state.
In the past, geography helped Iran to become a multinational empire. How would geography impact the future of Iran?
Yes, Iran is a natural state occupying the Iranian plateau. Iranian kingdoms on the Iranian plateau or near it have governed large parts of the Middle East going back to antiquity. Iran or Persia was the ancient world's first superpower. And if you look at Iran's influence today, however nefarious, it stretches from the Mediterranean to central Afghanistan, which is more or less the borders of the old empires of the Achaemenids, the Sassanids, the Medes and the Parthians, which were all roughly Iranian. Iran is a real state. It's got real institutions. It's got different power centers. It's probably not going to collapse anytime soon. It's probably sturdier than Saudi Arabia, its rival. Therefore, I think ultimately a U.S.-Iranian rapprochement has to be in the cards. It's just a matter of how it will happen and when it will happen.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is best-selling author Robert Kaplan. We're discussing his 2012 book entitled The Revenge of Geography, What the Map Tells Us About Coming Conflicts and the Battle Against Fate. His most recently published book is Asia's Cauldron, The South China Sea, and The End of a Stable Pacific. Joining me on the program is Mohammed El-Shenawy, senior reporter in VOA's English division, and I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you, so please send an email with your feedback to PCUSA@voanews.com. And now another question from Mohammed.
Mr. Kaplan, for an ordinary person who wants to believe your theory, what are the most vivid examples in the world history?
I would say the most vivid example is China. China has thousands of miles of coastline in the tropics and in the temperate zone. It's a continental-sized country that borders the mineral riches and natural resources of Central Asia. The northernmost part of China, Manchuria, is the same latitude as Maine. The southernmost point of China, Hainan Island, is the same latitude as the Florida Keys. So China spatially is a moderate temperate zone country, very much like the United States, and this aided its development. Just as building a grand canal connecting the Yellow and Yangtze rivers in the 7th century was the equivalent of the United States building the Transcontinental Railroad in the 19th century. So this aided China's development greatly. Then take Russia, for example, which lies north of 50 degrees north latitude. It's in the latitudes of Canada and is even colder because Canadian cities are all in the south along the U.S. border. Russian cities are way up there in the north. And this has fostered a short growing season, a strong sense of communalism, all of which had contributed to the kind of extreme governments and autocracy that you've had. There was a great British historian, Hugh Seton Watson, who wrote that Russia is the country in the world most geographically suited for autocracy. That autocracy is natural to Russia because of the cold climate, the vast distances, the need for extremes of central control are very vital. Then there is the United States of America. The United States of America has more miles of inland waterway than the rest of the world combined. This aided the settlement from the east to the west. The United States is a grand continental island in the temperate zone, with just the Canadian Arctic to the north, with the only problematic border with Mexico to the south. It was the last resource-rich part of the temperate zone settled during the European Enlightenment. Americans love to say we're great because of who we are. I would say Americans are great also because where they happen to live.
Robert Kaplan, I want to turn to Africa, not only because we have a large audience, but also to discuss the implications of your thesis for that continent. There are so many artificial colonial borders. They're coming apart as we speak. How do you see the influence of culture and geography on the continent, and what is the trajectory?
Well, remember, the European colonialists replaced local African empires. It wasn't empire replacing states. It was European empires replacing indigenous African empires in Africa. Africa is the hottest continent. It lies more equally astride the equator than any other continent. This subjects it to weak soils and to disease, which is inhibited development. Also, the deep forested nature of the central part of the continent has inhibited strong central government. What we see going on now is a race for natural resources in Africa, which is also geographical and where the Chinese are taking the lead, building roads, pipelines, and rail networks from the coasts, whether it's the Indian Ocean in East Africa or the South Atlantic in Southwest Africa near Angola. And all these routes are going inland towards the center to get at the riches of the continent. And yet the center of the continent, the Central African Republic, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, etc., have seen no development because they're just too far inland in a way. And this is where we find the weakest government and the most instability.
So if we think about history, geography, and strategy, what role you foresee for the U.S. in the world and in the Western Hemisphere?
The United States is essentially a power that has dominated the Western Hemisphere since it took control of the Greater Caribbean at the end of the 19th century. So it's the dominant Western Hemispheric force which has allowed it to affect the balance of power in the Eastern Hemisphere, which is the story of the 20th century. In other words, first the Greater Caribbean, later the world. Though taking control of the Caribbean unlocked the world for the United States. The United States is a liberal maritime power, which means it protects not just its own survival, but that of the world trading system. The U.S. Navy loves to have a phrase on their recruitment ads, "Join the Navy, a global force for good." Well, it's actually true, because what the Navy does is protect the sea lines of communications around the world, without which trade would be impossible. So without the U.S. Navy, no globalization, no Davos, period, essentially.
Would geography repeat the old fault lines, since geography is constant and we are moving from past to future?
Geography is more subtle now than it's ever been because of the influence of technology, fast transport. It'll be more subtle on one side, allowing more and more for human agency, but it'll be more precious on the other side, because with more and more people on this earth, people will fight harder and harder for scraps of ground and water, particularly if those scraps of ground and bodies of water contain natural resources, like in the South China Sea.
Exactly. I wanted you to address that very topic, Robert Kaplan. You know, what are the implications for China's aggressive moves in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, with the declaration of the air defense zone, rattling Japan and other countries. So where is this going, and what can the U.S. do, if anything?
China sees the South and East China Seas the way the United States saw the Caribbean 125 years ago. China has settled its continent. It's taken back Hong Kong. It's taken back Macau. It's enveloping Taiwan, essentially making an end run around Taiwanese sovereignty. And so now it wants to extend its control to its adjacent seas. If it can dominate the South China Sea, it unlocks the door to the Indian Ocean. And the Indian Ocean is the entire arc of Islam, from the Sahara Desert to the Malay and Indonesian archipelagos. China is building or financing deep water ports throughout the Indian Ocean. It's building a two-ocean trading empire, all the way from the eastern Mediterranean to the western Pacific. So China sees the United States and its allies in the South and East China Seas and says, you, America, you've come from half a world away here. Therefore, you are hegemonic. Whereas we, China, are the demographic and economic organizing principle of the Asia Pacific. So we are here by our right to dominate. And so China's claims in the South China Sea directly conflict with those of Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, just like its claims in the East China Sea directly conflict with those of Japan.
So, again, what should the United States do? The United States sees itself as a Pacific nation. It talks about rebalancing in Asia. How can the United States combat this type of aggression and come to the allies in the region who are looking to the United States for leadership?
The United States has to steer between two extremes in the Asia Pacific. On the one hand, it cannot let Vietnamese and Filipino nationalism, for example, or Japanese nationalism, for example, get the United States embroiled in a conflict with China. Because the U.S.-China relationship is the most important bilateral relationship in the world for the 21st century. And it involves currency, climate control, trade, lots of issues. So the U.S. cannot allow these other nations to lure America into a conflict with China. On the other hand, the U.S. cannot allow China to Finlandize Malaysia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Japan. Finlandize, I'm referring to the Cold War, when the Soviet Union essentially controlled neighboring Finland's foreign policy.
After applying your theory to almost every place in the world, a curious reader would wonder, how did you detect the strong relationship between geography and what shapes history?
I always love maps. And I always saw maps as the starting point for knowledge, that knowledge doesn't end with maps, but where it began. Also, as a foreign correspondent for several decades, what was apparent to me was the differences in groups and cultures, in their perceptions. But what is a culture? A culture is just the common experience of a large group of people occupying the same geography going back hundreds or thousands of years, which forms certain traits and ways of looking at the world and perspective. Now, of course, the individuals in these cultures are much more concrete than any generalizations you could make about culture. Nevertheless, you have to generalize or else you will immobilize analysis.
And as we conclude, Robert Kaplan, what is the relevance of geography for the United States in the 21st century?
The United States has to recognize that Americans hate the word empire and imperialism, but they are historically in an imperial-like situation with responsibilities that go with it. The responsibilities of protecting the global commons for trade, of using air and sea power to keep the peace in Asia, to keep some measure of stability in the greater Middle East, in Europe. Democracies as diverse as Poland and Taiwan could not really exist without this American security armature. And America will have an abundant wealth because of shale gas reserves. America is going to be the most energy-rich country going forward decades. So American power is not on the wane.
Indeed, they can really leverage that even vis-a-vis what we're seeing with Russia.
Yes, because Russia's now like the leading top dog in the natural gas market. But 8 years from now, that will not be the case.
So if we're in it for the long game, we could counter Russia's aggressive moves in Europe.
Yes, this is not a time for the United States to withdraw from the world because it has too many responsibilities. And most of its actions will not be military. They will be leveraging economics and diplomacy in most countries. But you get your diplomatic leverage from the strength of your economy and your ability to deploy your military. Not necessarily to go to war, but to deploy your warships and airplanes.
And how would you see the direction of U.S. foreign policy today, particularly under Obama?
I would say that the Obama administration evinces some level of exhaustion with the world. The United States is still emotionally in a post-Iraq war phase, and so it's hesitant to get involved. But this phase won't last. They never do. Something will happen, whether tomorrow or in 5 years, or maybe it's already happening, that will move the American people and all the experts in Washington out of the post-Iraq war phase into something else.
The books are The Revenge of Geography, What the Map Tells Us About Coming Conflicts and the Battle Against Fate, and Asia's Cauldron, The South China Sea and the End of a Stable Pacific. The author, Robert Kaplan. Robert, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Wojtek Zorniak. Joining me on the program was Mohammed El-Shanawi, senior reporter in VOA's English division. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.